PD Heart, Pediatric Cardiology Today. My name is Dr. Robert Pass, and I'm the host of this podcast. I'm Professor of Pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Thank you so much for joining me this week for our 215th episode of the podcast. I hope everybody enjoyed last week's episode, episode 214, on the topic of healthcare disparities. We spoke with Professor Tara Karamlu of the Cleveland Clinic about a recent large-scale study that she performed looking at FIST database information. For those of you with an interest in the topic of healthcare equity, I'd strongly recommend you take a listen to last week's episode 214. As I say every week, if you'd like to get in touch with me, it's easy to remember my email. It's pdheart@gmail.com. This week, we move on to the world of cardiac surgery. And the title of the work we'll be reviewing is In-Hospital Morbidity and Mortality After Modified Blalock-Taussig Thomas Shunts. The first author of this work is Andrew Hedrick, and the senior author, Mark Anders. And this work comes to us from Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital. When we're done reviewing the paper, Dr. Hedrick, who's presently a second-year cardiology fellow at the University of Utah, has graciously agreed to speak with us about it. Therefore, let's move straight on to the article, and then a conversation about BTT shunts. This week, our paper is on a topic that's been reviewed in the literature a lot in the past, but it's a good, shall we say, update on the latest and greatest on BTT shunts. And the authors explain that the modified BTT shunt is used for many different forms of congenital heart disease with diminished or absent pulmonary blood flow. And they speak of the high morbidity and mortality rates that have been reported with it. They reference figures from other works of 6-17% of patients having a cardiac arrest or ECMO after shunting, with in-house mortality rates of 5-14%, and shunt malfunctions of 5-13%. They note in this work that since the modified BTT shunt is still a necessary procedure saving the lives of many patients and is still associated with these high morbidity and mortality rates, continued study of this with emphasis on surgical approach and anastomosis site and their contributions to outcomes is warranted. And so the group basically looked back on their experience at Texas Children's Hospital to figure out which demographics, anatomy, or perioperative factors would impart higher risk for early postoperative morbidity, prolonged hospital stay, or even mortality. And they hypothesized that factors increasing resistance along the systemic to PA shunt would predispose patients to both morbidity and mortality. They performed a retrospective review of kids undergoing a shunt at Texas Children's Hospital by performing an internal query of their STS database from 2008 to 2018, so 10 years. They excluded patients who had hypoplastic left heart syndrome or ductal-dependent systemic circulation or a previous history of cardiac surgery or central shunt, and they reviewed a lot of operative and perioperative variables. For this work, a serious adverse event was a composite outcome including shunt malfunction, cardiac arrest, post-op ECMO cannulation, or unplanned urgent reintervention. Shunt malfunction was defined as an acute event causing compromise in hypoxemia with either echo, CT angio, or cath evidence for reduced shunt flow. The primary outcome in this work was an early, less than 30-day serious adverse event, or in-hospital mortality, with secondary outcomes being time to occurrence of a primary outcome, postoperative ICU length of stay, and total length of stay. And on to the results. There's a very nice research diagram map, figure 1, which is on page 169 of this manuscript, and it shows that the authors found initially 353 patients from the group from 2008 to 2018, but after they removed people who were in the exclusion criteria, they ended up with a total of 155 total patients for study. Of these 155 patients, we see that 21.3% of the patients had a serious early adverse event, 6.5% of the patients had early shunt malfunction, 4.5% of the patients required ECMO, or 7 patients, and 11 patients, or 7.1%, had an in-hospital mortality, again demonstrating what we've seen in prior works of the great risk associated with BTT shunts. In order to cut to the chase here, I'll review what factors the authors identified that were associated with morbidity or mortality. First, shunt size. And perhaps not surprisingly, the lowest risk shunt for a problem was the 4.0mm shunt, which was used in the majority of patients at Texas Children's Hospital, followed by 3.5mm and then 3.0mm shunt. And the hazard ratio for a serious adverse event was nearly 3 for the 3.5mm shunt in comparison with the 4. And then for the 3mm shunt, the hazard ratio was higher still at 7.4 in comparison with the 4.0mm shunt. And there's a very nice survival curve, very clearly demonstrating that for a shunt, in general, bigger was better. The location of the shunt proximally was also important, with the authors showing that placement on the subclavian artery was associated with the best survival, with innominate being substantially worse, though the total number of patients who had innominate shunts was small, and carotid shunting, which was seen in very few patients, was universally bad. The authors also showed that PAZ score, being small, was associated with worse outcomes. When they performed univariable proportional hazard modeling, there were three independent variables that were significantly associated with reduction in risk for mortality, and these were increasing the shunt size, increasing PAZ score, and anastomosis to the subclavian artery rather than the innominate or carotid. Importantly, the presence of competitive or forward pulmonary artery flow did not affect these outcomes. In their discussion, the authors speak about the BTT shunt and re-emphasize how native prograde pulmonary blood flow was seen in a lot of these cases, roughly a third, but this was not associated with worse outcomes, and this was true also for those who had competitive collateral or ductal flow. They also mention how adverse events were not different between single and two ventricle patients who were getting a shunt in this study. They make an interesting point regarding their preference for a thoracotomy for BTT shunts, and state, and I quote, "Our institution specifically practices shunt placement using thoracotomy when amenable, an approach that allows for easy access to the subclavian artery distal to the subclavian innominate junction. In this scenario, the subclavian artery serves as the point of maximal resistance along the SPS tract, consistent with Vivian Thomas's original animal model shunt design. This is in contrast to what has become the more common surgical practice across most institutions of palliation using sternotomy, wherein the subclavian is less accessible, and anastomosis is most typically made to the innominate artery." The authors refer us to a prior work showing inferiority of the innominate artery attachment for a BTT shunt with high mortality and morbidity rates in those prior studies. They explain how putting the shunt on the subclavian has the advantage of putting the maximal resistance in the subclavian artery and not the shunt, and may allow for placement of a larger shunt, which has been shown in this work and in the works of others to be associated with fewer problems. They re-emphasize the finding that smaller shunt size was the most highly associated factor for a bad outcome. They conclude the work by comparing their superior outcomes to those of other works on this topic, where mortality and morbidity figures have been roughly 5 to 10% higher than the ones reported in this work. And they end by suggesting, quote, "Although there are certainly cases where such an approach is not plausible, thoracotomy and anastomosis to the subclavian artery is an approach that may eliminate a portion of morbidity, mortality, and healthcare costs in cases where palliation of impeded pulmonary blood flow with a modified Blaylock-Taussig-Thomas shunt is indicated." Well, this is certainly an interesting project in showing us sort of real world, how is this working at one of the largest world center results of the BTT shunt. Though this has been studied previously by many different institutions, I do think checking in with centers of excellence to see how things are progressing is of use. And this work clearly shows us something that we already know, which is that placement of a BTT shunt is not a minor procedure, associated with a lot of morbidity and mortality. And for this reason, it's assigned a very high RAC score, and this work shows us why. I find it of interest that the team prefers a thoracotomy approach, as it appears that many surgeons are moving towards a sternotomy approach for better anatomical delineation and avoidance of the ills of thoracotomy. I also wonder if there are any inadvertent placement of shunts to the right upper lobe PA, which has, at least in the past, been one of the arguments against this approach. Indeed, many patients in the past have lost their right upper lobe pulmonary artery due to this possible complication. Finally, I found it of interest that the presence of competitive prograde flow did not have a meaningful negative impact on shunt survival or outcomes. These are amongst many of the questions or things that I thought about as I reviewed this paper, and something I think we should talk about with Dr. Hedrick. And so in the interest of time, let's move straight on to our conversation with the first author, Dr. Andrew Hedrick. Joining us now to discuss this week's work is Dr. Andrew Hedrick, who's the work's first author. Dr. Hedrick is a graduate of Indiana University for his undergraduate studies and a graduate of the University of Alabama for medical school. He completed his residency at Texas Children's Hospital, where he performed the research we're reviewing this week, and he is now a second-year cardiology fellow at Primary Children's Hospital. Welcome, Andrew, to the podcast.
I'm here now with Dr. Andrew Hedrick. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us this week on the podcast.
Thanks, Dr. Pass. It's nice to be on here with you.
Thank you. I know that you're a busy fellow, so very exciting that we could find a few moments in your day. For those in the audience, although it's towards the end of my day, it's right smack in the middle of the busy time for a fellow. So thank you very, very much, Andrew. Andrew, I very much enjoyed this paper because it allowed us an opportunity to look at something that we do all the time and get a good sense of what it's like in the present era in 2021-22. One of the most important observations of your work was that placement of a BTT shunt on the subclavian artery was best, and this is most easily performed from a thoracotomy, at least according to the article, rather than a sternotomy because of what the authors describe as difficulty of getting the subclavian from the front, reaching it. Similarly, placing a shunt on the subclavian because of its smaller size, the authors of your work, yourself of course, allows more resistance to flow and therefore allows placement of maybe a larger shunt for a smaller patient. I'm wondering, for a lot of us who are non-surgeons, and I know, of course, you are as well, if you could speak to how hard it is to place, for example, a 4-millimeter shunt on a smallish subclavian artery. Is it challenging, for example, to anastomose a 4-millimeter structure to a vessel that's smaller than 4 millimeters?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I appreciate the kind of introduction and background on that. I think this is a really good question that dives into the surgical technical practices that are really laid out in this paper. And on that, I discussed this previously with one of my co-authors and one of the fantastic congenital heart surgeons at Texas Children's, Dr. Heinle. Dr. Heinle's take was that typically shunt size is at the surgeon's discretion, but is guided by both patient weight and the surgical approach, and then ultimately the size of the innominate or other proximal anastomosis site, such as subclavian, as seen at the time of surgery. And overall, though it's more challenging to do via sternotomy through this period at Texas Children's, even when approaching from the front, the surgeon did try to make all efforts to dissect superiorly as possible to access the subclavian. And when the subclavian was accessible, if the child was large enough, a 4-millimeter shunt was going to be placed with the knowledge that the subclavian then would act as the primary resistor along that tract. Mm-hmm. And so while this is technically challenging if the subclavian is small, it was very much the philosophy and practice in this era and thus typically pursued. And, you know, I went back a little bit into the numbers to look at this, and it really plays out there as well. And so when you look at, in our cohort, shunts by size, 4-millimeter shunts were placed on the subclavian about 59% of the time, as opposed to placement on the innominate only 17% of the time. So if you, say, have a child that weighs like 3 kilograms and are approaching via thoracotomy, the child's almost certainly going to receive a 4-millimeter shunt. And when we dig into the data, of the 59 kids in our cohort that met that specific description, 83% ended up getting a 4-millimeter shunt.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I guess the bottom line is it's doable because it was done.
So. No, I think that's spot on. I think, albeit technically challenging, it fit with the philosophy, and thus, you know, was felt worth the extra effort to make it feasible.
I have to say that when I was still working at Columbia over a decade ago, Dr. Ralph Mosca used to routinely put 4-millimeter BT shunts in, and I think he had a sort of similar philosophy, which was that it never really was effectively a 4-millimeter shunt, because I'm sure you're aware that in the old days when they didn't have 3.5-millimeter shunts, it was viewed as a great progress in technology when they came up with 3.5-millimeter shunts, because children were always in very bad heart failure, apparently, in the era when 4-millimeter was the smallest. But I think perhaps maybe those were being placed more proximally, not taking advantage maybe of the narrowing of the subclavian artery, which was the source of resistance. You know, in your work, Andrew, although the numbers were smaller, you just hinted about the concept of placing the shunt on the innominate artery, which was actually more associated with worse outcomes in your work. Intuitively, it would seem that this would not be the case, as I would have imagined that attachment of a shunt to a larger structure might be technically easier. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on why it seemed as if patients who had their shunt attached to the innominate actually didn't do quite as well.
No, I agree that it's likely more technically challenging. But again, you know, the thought process during this period at Texas Children's was that the potential benefit likely warranted this. And so that is to say that while it could theoretically lead to longer surgical times to allow for adequate dissection to access the subclavian artery, the benefit to hemodynamic management in the CICU postoperatively is what is suggested in the morbidity statistics that are laid out in this paper. So essentially, the theory goes that if the shunt is anastomosed to the dominant artery, you have no control over the flow going into the shunt. And with this, you're forced to place a smaller shunt to act as the resistor along that circuit. Rather, if you place the shunt more distally in the subclavian artery, this allows for more liberal shunt size and will allow for optimization of hemodynamics in the postoperative period. And so, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, very interesting.
Yeah. And so when you look at the source numbers, this is what really underpinned the multivariate model that we saw that's displayed in figure two in the paper. And so for the innominate vein, anastomosed patients that got 3.5 millimeter shunts, for example, the rate of early morbidity was almost 56%. Whereas of the 82 patients that received a 4 millimeter BT shunt to the subclavian, only 11% had some early serious adverse event. And these are, you know, digging a little bit deeper into the numbers that aren't necessarily reported in the paper. But as you know, running back on the morbidity and mortality, there was even some post-analysis discussion around the paper because of the surprise with the extent of mortality. It was found that, you know, mortality in this cohort was at least partly due probably to the inclusion of patients that had rather complex heart disease and specifically required other concomitant surgical repairs, such as total anomalous pulmonary venous connection repairs, of which there were 16 in the cohort. And so when we even accounted then for those and took those out, the in-hospital mortality rate actually dropped even lower to only 3.9%.
Interesting. I didn't notice that, but that's a very important point. Fixing the pulmonary veins at the same time as a shunt is a very dangerous endeavor, for sure. You know, along the same lines about shunt size that we were just talking about, your work showed that, as in many other works on this topic, use of a smaller shunt was associated with more adverse events, with particular risk when using the 3.0 millimeter shunt. I was wondering if the group at Texas is using 3.0 millimeter shunts any longer, and if they are, in whom are they using them, and are they taking any special precautions? For example, are they using aspirin with clopidogrel or one or the other? And do shunts patients in Texas get treated with antiplatelet agents in general? And since you're now in Utah, what's the practice there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is a complicated question. And with regards to 3.0 shunts, I think that's become even progressively rarer. You know, I was talking to a couple of my co-authors in this vein specifically, and they couldn't remember the last time that a 3 millimeter shunt was placed. And then in regards to the sort of anticoagulation practices, I'm not aware actually of any great data that suggests what the best practice anticoagulation protocols are in shunted patients postoperatively. And during this 10-year period covered in the study at Texas Children's, there are actually several inflection points where the postoperative anticoagulation protocols for shunted patients changed. So I think it'd be hard to make any inferences specifically in this cohort about how that may have influenced things. But most recently at TCH, the practice has returned to using prophylactic heparin at 10 units per kg per hour until about 24 hours postoperatively, when patients, if it seems like a stable and safe thing to do, are switched over to aspirin. And then following aspirin initiation, a verified now platelet function assay is sent, and the regimen is then adjusted thereafter based on the individual patient response.
Interesting.
And then here at, in Utah at Primary Children's, we typically empirically start aspirin on all shunted patients on postoperative day one. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're incredibly fortunate at Primaries to have our cardiac anticoagulation team, Drs. Carly Hayrent and Lindsay May, who assist with tailored plans in our more complex and partially high-risk cases. And occasionally we'll recommend the use of Lovenox or additional antiplatelet therapy whenever warranted.
I see. Well, for those listeners to the podcast, you may remember that reference to Dr. Hayrent, one of the best guests we've ever had on the podcast, pharmacist par excellence. Really, what a wonderful resource you must have in Utah to have Dr. Hayrent on the other end of the phone for any questions. You know, Andrew, one of the potential disadvantages of BTT shunts from a thoracotomy, I was always taught, was the risk of inadvertently placing it on the right upper lobe pulmonary artery, which can result in loss of the right upper lobe pulmonary artery. And I have to say, I have seen that in a handful of cases in the past. I'm wondering if you might be able to share with us any tricks that the surgeons have in Texas to avoid this. And was there any evidence for this problem in any of the patients in this cohort, or did you not, were you not able to ferret that out?
Yeah, and so, this is, again, a question that I kind of had to put to Dr. Jeff Heinle to get the surgical expertise in perspective. And certainly, in this cohort, I wasn't specifically looking for that. So I can't say whether or not empirically I know that to be true. But anecdotally, Dr. Heinle's comments were that he was unaware of any such previous cases of inadvertent placement of the shunt on the right upper lobe branch. He commented that, in his experience, even when coming from a thoracotomy, you should be able to dissect adequately to delineate the upper lobe branch and stay off that. There is certainly, situations where you may have a short segment RPA resulting in a necessity of anastomosis to the NPA, or potentially, RPA with the inclusion of a portion of the proximal portion of the right upper lobe branch, but certainly not isolated.
I see. Okay. Well, Andrew, I'm bothering you in the middle of your busy day, so I'm going to finish up with one last question. I found it interesting that the presence of competitive prograde or prograde pulmonary blood flow did not seem to affect the incidence of serious adverse events in shunted patients. And this has been suggested as a risk factor in other BTT shunt reports. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on why this was not a risk in your group. And I was wondering if maybe it was your belief that it was due to the more distal positioning of the shunt on the RPA because of the technique that's used from a thoracotomy. I just was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a great point, whether or not the actual anatomic separation makes a difference. And, I think this is a question I was particularly interested in well as I started to dig into this data, because it's not an uncommon debate that you hear whether the presence of prograde blood flow may impede flow and thus increase the risk for shunt malfunction, or some that may argue the flip side of the coin that leaving pulmonary blood flow can provide a sort of safety measure and buy time to rescue the kid in the event of a shunt malfunction. And I think at least the data for the latter theory has suggested that there really isn't any risk reduction. For example, in the Advanced Interstage Monitoring Project, they demonstrated that when they took a cohort of patients of that had HLHS and added in those with native prograde pulmonary blood flow, say like a shunted tetralogy of flow patient, that the rates of interstage events didn't really significantly change. In regards to the data in our paper, I also kind of wondered if it might just be too diverse of a cohort of underlying congenital cardiac pathology to hone in on this specific question. Beyond that, in the supplemental section, I drilled into a little bit more on this, some of the key differences in the kids that had no native pulmonary blood flow versus those with. And in kids with no native pulmonary blood flow, they tended to be significantly lower weight at the time of surgery, to more frequently undergo sternotomy, to have higher rates of bypass use, and to have longer bypass times. And so I think it's actually even more interesting that despite all these related potential risk factors, that we didn't see a significant morbidity difference in those patients. And we looked at the native versus those that had native pulmonary blood flow versus those that were absent, and the morbidity rates were 18 and 24% respectively. So yeah, I would chalk it up to either the diversity of the cohort pathology sort of diluting the ability to focus on that specific question, or maybe that there just really is no additional risk or benefit to leaving native pulmonary blood flow.
I see. Okay, very interesting theory on this. Well, Andrew, I really can't thank you enough. I really think this is a very important paper, particularly in light of the fact that we are increasingly stenting ductuses. And so the ability or our opportunity to study blalactosic Thomas shunts is probably going to become limited as time passes. And so a lot of the pearls that your paper has provided could prove to be very, very important, particularly as the BTT shunt becomes a little less commonly used in the era of interventional cardiology. I really appreciate your time today. I have lots of good friends in Utah, including my dear friend Bob Gray, the head of the cath lab, little known fact, former fellow of mine. So if you see Bob, send him my best. And of course, your wonderful chief, Antonio Cabrera. So thank you so much. And congratulations to you and all of the co-investigators at Texas Children's. Yet again, a wonderful paper from the group in Texas. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Pass, for having me on.
Well, once again, we had the great pleasure of speaking with yet another up-and-coming superstar of cardiology in Dr. Hedrick. He shared with us a lot of information regarding BTT shunts and some of the technical aspects of this surgery, which was really remarkable, particularly given that he is not a surgeon.
I found many of his comments regarding smaller shunts, as well as why a subclavian location for the shunt, to be very interesting and insightful, and I'm sure you did as well. I'd like to thank Dr. Hedrick for taking time from his extremely busy schedule to speak with us this week on the podcast. To conclude this 215th episode of PD Heart Pediatric Cardiology Today, we'll hear the wonderful Italian tenor Giuseppe Di Stefano. Di Stefano would be 101 years old this week, and in this recording from the very start of his career, we'll hear him sing the lovely aria "È la solita storia del pastore" from Chilea's rarely performed opera, L'Arzelliana. Thank you very much for joining me for this 215th episode, and thanks very much to Dr. Hedrick. I hope everybody has a wonderful week ahead.
È la solita storia del pastore. Il povero ragazzo vuole raccontarla. Nel sole.